set tape two, side two, so that you found now you have notes from conferences with Vienna on telemetry as early as February.
Early February 42, yeah.
Okay. So so that it was about that time that they were brought in, you think, or maybe
right.
even
mm-hmm.
that they were brought into trying to greatly improve the telemetry capability
right. mm-hmm.
later in the war. And do you think that the Technical University of Berlin was brought in at some point later on? Do you think?
As a matter of fact, we worked together with Vienna.
Okay.
We arranged for that. Yeah, that the Berlin should support Vienna, but Vienna went ahead. Yeah, they were more effective than the Berlin people. Yeah.
Right, that's two groups working very far apart.
Yeah,
there would have been coordination problems, I'm sure, among other things.
The fortunate thing with the Vienna people, where they were very good in theoretical terms, but they could do something with it. Yeah, they could build something.
No, so they could actually build an effective transmitter.
The Berlin people were much more on the theoretical side. Yeah? They had lots of ideas, yeah, but they had a kind of a hard time to materialize it. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. So then in conclusion, as against what the rocket team says, you were at least somewhat satisfied with the telemetry development that you had on A4.
Sure, I mean... particularly for the essential things, which were the power plant measurements and then the control system measurements. We had at least something. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. You had some kind of, and given the limits of the technology, you did reasonably well in the long run in getting telemetry. I had another question that connected to this. And that is the issue of range safety. I noted from, I think it was reading Dornberger's book, the problem of accidents and, you know, missiles falling back on the territory of the Peenemünde Ost, or sometimes even Peenemünde West. And I wondered why you didn't have any destruct system, range safety kind of system that existed. That is considered normal now.
Yeah.
What was that considered?
Well, I think, what should I say? Looking back, I think our dear military part, actually, they had a responsibility. They were a kind of careless.
Right. They didn't really consider the effects.
Yeah.
The possible dangers.
Mm-hmm. You see, you might have read or seen pictures that we had a very nice residential area in Peenemünde where we lived. Yeah.
Right.
And one of the missiles went back towards the settlement. Yeah, and just 300 meters before from the boundary of the settlement. The thing went into the forest and exploded in the forest, but it was sheer luck.
It was a terrible disaster. That gave people quite a scare at that time. Had the concept of a range safety sort of destruct system even been considered?
Yeah, well, the funny thing was we didn't protect our own people carefully
right.
enough, but on the firing range out along the Baltic coast, yeah,
right.
We had the Navy and whatnot engaged in blocking off certain areas where we thought something could happen. Yeah, for instance, beneath the cut-off location. Yeah, and then of course the impact area, they were sealed off. Yeah,
right.
By some kind of boats, Navy boats, but not our our mm-hmm. own people. Yeah.
It just didn't seem like it was that likely that it would ever fall back.
It was a kind of, what do you call it?
It was just taken, the danger was taken for granted.
Yeah.
As a fact of life, of the business at that point.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's not like you didn't take any measures. Obviously, Test Stand 7, the main launch area, had a big wall around it, built around
now,
it, and it was at the far north end.
We had radio commands, yeah?
Right.
But when should you shut it off? When would be the safest instant, yeah?
Mm-hmm. There's no way of really knowing.
That's not easy to decide, huh?
Especially if it's coming back towards
the west. It worse if, rather than let it go. So hopefully some farther out, yeah, and
right.
Then shut it off. Yeah.
Okay. So as far as that is concerned, it really wasn't something that anyone considered seriously at the time. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so telemetry. Connecting to, I think finally finishing up what talking about all the different things you're involved in. Have we left anything out on the major projects we've talked about so far in your involvement in this?
We talked about the accelerometers yesterday.
Right. And we talked about the Volman system, the gyros, telemetry.
Of course, there were certain gadgets which were in the measurement domain. For instance, the torque measurements for the control rudders.
Right.
That was still in my area, yeah? Because it was carried by the missile. Yeah? That was a pretty important thing, these torque measurements. Yeah?
In order to understand the workings of the control system.
Yeah, and then to make sure that we had a large enough control range. Yeah?
Right.
In other words, that we could supply strong enough control forces with the rudders.
Right. You're not talking about the air rudders, you're talking about in the gas stream.
Both air and jet rudders.
Okay. I guess to finish up on that whole period, some point Steinhoff came, right? Was he there? I was under the impression he was there only from, say, 1940 or so. Am I mm-hmm. incorrect? He was there earlier.
No, he came in the late summer of 1938.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, Steuding brought him to Peenemünde. He had worked with him in this glider plane research institute. Yeah. And it was an unfortunate thing that he brought him up. Steinhoff was a very controversial figure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think in the end he did more damage to the whole project than the real promoted.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's very important for historians to know, because I haven't seen that anywhere. What was it that why was he controversial? What was it that he did that created problems?
Yeah, well, you have to realize he was responsible for a huge area, yeah? All the electronics gimmicks. Yeah?
He came in as the head of all electronics.
Yeah. And he wasn't competent.
No.
He had not a bit of industrial experience, at least had the Siemens experience myself. Yeah? And not to compare with Wollmann or people like that, I mean, Ullmann was here and Steinhoff was here. Yeah?
Steinhoff was there, yeah, so.
But he didn't want
Steinhoff
to admit it.
Yeah? Wasn't very good
he
at
had,
all.
He had always a big mouth, yeah? and he was actually kind of a bad Nazi. Yeah?
Really?
Forcing people into things which were unreasonable, like most of the Nazi things were unreasonable. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
But he had the power and he forced. I was actually the one who built up the electronics department. Eh?
Right. It certainly sounds that way.
Of course, I didn't have any experience in control at the time. Eh? I just gained it with my test stand measurements. Yeah? And Steinhoff allegedly was a control man, but he wasn't. The control man was Steuding. Yeah? And he really looked through things. Yeah?
So Steuding was really responsible for control theory, as you said before, and the development of that whole side. Mm-hmm. What was Steinhoff's training? Well, he was an engineer, I assume. Right? Was he a diplôme ingénieur or was
he was diplôme ingénieur from Darmstadt? He I think he basically was a meteorologist. And he got into flying. The thing he really could accomplish was flying. He was one of the most outstanding pilots I ever encountered.
Right.
And he was particularly, in the beginning at least, he was a glider pilot, and he made some records.
Right. So you described in your first interview that he held a long distance
record.
See,
he flew from the Wasserkuppe, which is near Frankfurt. Yeah.
Right.
Not too far from Frankfurt, into Czechoslovakia to Brno. Yeah. Well, that was a deed. Yeah.
In an unpowered aircraft.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. In a glider. So he was then a real party man.
He wasn't actually active in party matters, mm-hmm. but he had
enthusiastic.
Yeah, well, and the, what do you call it, the attitude of a typical Nazi, yeah? I tell you do that, yeah, and you better do it. Yeah?
Right, authoritarian.
Yeah, absolutely. And in many, many instances, absolutely unreasonable, yeah? Because he wasn't competent enough. Yeah? He got his doctorate then from Darmstadt, but I wonder how he got it.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote a thesis about glider instrumentation. Yeah? But I don't know, I can't prove anything, but I have my
You have your suspicions.
Doubts, so.
Can you specify any particular things over which there were big arguments, ever particular, like telemetry or anything else,
and
which he might have done damage?
He was so erratic in anything he did, yeah? He could give an order right now, 2 hours later he gave the contrary order, yeah? And things like that, yeah? Which is unbearable in such a complicated, knitted thing like a missile is. As a matter of fact, I had to pay for my opposition to Steinhoff, yeah, because my dear friend, I can't do things you order me to do because it's absolutely unreasonable. Yeah? Of course, he didn't like to hear that. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And then someday there was a showdown, yeah, and with von Braun and being present. It was a shortcoming from Braun. He was too loyal to his people. Yeah? He should have thrown Steinhoff out, yeah? Because he did so much damage to the organization. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And someday, it was actually then turned out to be a discussion about telemetry. Yeah? And Steinhoff complained that I didn't make enough progress and didn't improve fast enough. And I said, my dear friend, you know I have these personnel problems. I have hardly bodies to consistently work on that. And then I was fortunate. I got an officer, a single corps officer, who actually was a diploma engineer in telecommunications, a very nice fellow, very agreeable in everything you worked with him. And I just noticed that he didn't work on the assignments anymore, and we discussed it in presence of von Braun. And von Braun said, you are naive, don't you know that Steinhoff gave this man and his co-workers to the commander to operate a radio communication link? Yeah? I almost fell from my chair. Yeah? He didn't tell me. And then I was naive enough to ask von Braun, well, couldn't we go to Obersansen and ask him whether he could be kind enough to return these people? He was reasonable enough to realize telemetry was more important for the whole development than this silly radio link. I don't even know what purpose it was for. And then von Braun said, yeah, you are naive. Steinhoff offered this man to Zansen. Zansen didn't demand it. Steinhoff said, I have it, I can give it to you. That was typical Steinhoff. Yeah,
about what time was that? Can you pin that down?
That was in early 43. And of course, Steinhoff got cooking mad at me that I lifted all these topics. Yeah? And the result was that I, in a Saturday at noon, I got a telephone call from an administrative man and said, well, you go to the military office in Karlshagen and pick up your order to join the army.
Right. So you were sent, I remember the story from the first interview, you were sent into basic training and then drafted back on the VKN, Versuchskommando.
Yeah, and the result was that I wasn't trained in Germany. We were sent out, the whole division out to Russia.
To Crimea.
And Donberger was reasonable enough. He said it's impossible. Yeah? And Hansen was upset about the whole thing. And they called me back. Yeah, and could do that with the Fugger.
So that, in fact, they only called you back after they found that you'd already been transferred away? That is, in other words, you were drafted, they got you back later, or did you...
I wonder whether we should put it on the tape, because it's...
Let's start this again. Now, before we go on with the discussion of what happened to you after you were drafted and came back, I guess I wanted to just make sure that I'd covered all of the other issues that were left. Certainly one of the questions I have, I don't know how much you want to talk about it, is you certainly describe Steinhoff as a controversial personality. Was there anybody else who stood out as being a problem at that time, as, you know, for some members of the team? Or
is Klaus Riedel something you...
Yeah, I know who that is, yes.
He was a genius in his own right. He was actually first the director of the test stand operation. Yeah, and von Braun wasn't satisfied with his, although he was an old friend of him from the very early days.
He goes right back to Raketenflugplatz days.
Yeah. Which I can, in a certain way, I can understand. I don't actually know what was wrong with Riedel in that aspect. He was had a very good technical fantasy, but maybe he was too much fantasizing, and it wasn't systematic enough for the test. And for instance, he didn't want to write. But if you run a test, you better write a protocol. Yeah, and that where he lacked entirely. Yeah, and von Braun got mad in that. Yeah. And so he substituted him. But, and that's the thing where I then switched in. We had this problem with preparing the A4 system into the military operation.
Right.
Yeah?
Right.
And I don't know, did I mention it that von Braun went to Donberger and asked him, well, how should we do that? We have no idea. And he said there will be six general staff officers and doing it. They never came, and though we had to do it ourselves. And von Braun remembered the good technical fantasy of Riedel, and that was a total hit. It was amazing how Riedel solved this problem with his mobilized employment. It was fantastic.
So that after Klaus Riedel was pulled off the test stand, Seven, I guess that's where he was. All the test stands. He did do very good work with the launch system.
Which was not only putting the things on trucks or so, but the whole arrangement of the firing procedure. That was all his idea, what the general staff officers were supposed to do. He did it with his technical fantasy. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely amazing.
And that would be a considerably different, obviously, than launching it from a well-instrumented test stand.
Of course.
So that meant developing a whole new set of procedures.
I think we had, essentially, when I recall it right, 13 different vehicles which had to participate in the firing. Yeah? Now, well, at a certain moment, one vehicle might be in the way of the other one, yeah, and to fall around, yeah. And he resolved all these problems. Yeah.
This was largely in 1943.
When I came back from Russia.
That he had already
started. He was in the
started.
Middle of it then. And he, don't you know how he did it? I wonder whether I gave it to Protocol in the first interview. The empirical way, he got little toys made to his specifications, yeah? little cars, little trucks, yeah? With whatever they had to carry, a tank or a missile or whatever. And he played around with these things, yeah? And that's the way he found his structure, yeah, for for the arrangement for the firing, yeah? It was absolutely, I was amazed, you know. Mm-hmm.
So the problems with him before, when he was heading the test stand, was basically an issue of he wasn't a good manager in some ways of that whole thing in terms of
right.
writing things down.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a matter of being an abrasive personality.
No, he was a very likable guy, yeah. Had a very good sense of humor, yeah. Just a typical little sense. We lived pretty close in the Siedlung, in the
settlement.
In the settlement, yeah. And he liked jazz pretty much. He had a very, very fine music box at that time already, a very expensive thing from Siemens. And he liked jazz so much. And sometimes he was a little bit loud with his music, and we talked about it. And he said, well, you must understand that I'm more or less born with this, with liking jazz. Yeah. Do you know why? My father was a Navy officer, and he spent so much time in the tropics, and I think I inherited from him to like jazz, yeah, from the colored people. Yeah. It was his typical kind of humor. Yeah.
Yeah.
And another thing, which is typical of Klaus Riegel. At lunchtime, we met in the cafeteria, and was a certain round table always together, yeah? And we all liked coffee. But at that time, coffee was a rarity, yeah? And Riegel could get mad at that Goebbels, it's idiot, yeah? And Butter anstatt Kanon anstatt Butter and such nonsense, yeah? And at that time,
guns instead of butter.
Yeah, yeah.
Literally, yeah.
And at that time, the import of Brazil, the coffee, was more or less shut off by the Nazi government. And the reason was not that we need material for armament, but we didn't have enough foreign currency to pay for that. And Riedel said, they are so short-sighted, these people. Coffee makers, they dump their coffee into the sea to raise the prices, yeah? So, such an idiocy, he said. Now, couldn't we pay the Brazilians for their coffee with industry goods, for instance, with trucks, yeah? Daimler trucks, it was a big thing at that time, yeah? So, we send them the trucks over, they send the coffee, and it's an exchange kind of business. Now, if the Brazilians don't like our trucks, he could dump them in the sea instead of the coffee.
Right.
I wouldn't care. This was typical Klaus Riedel.
Yeah, so, not that they were too likely to send trucks overseas if they were starting a war. But so he was a very amusing person.
Well, yeah, just, and a very good sense of him, very likable, just very very social oriented. And
okay, so. Now, I had a question regarding that deployment issue. At least the sources say that earlier on, von Braun and some others really would rather prefer a big bunker.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, in effect, they were forced to take this road mobile system by Dornberger later on.
Yeah, do you know the story of these bunkers?
Somewhat. I've read some of the material on that. And, of course, obviously, part of
now,
the factor is Hitler liked huge bunkers,
of course,
too.
He liked huge concrete buildings. He had pretty good success with the bunkers for the submarines in Preston, Saint-Nazaire and whatnot. Yeah? And so he got the idea, oh, well, we could protect our submarines, why couldn't we protect the missiles? And he ordered, then, the building of these big, really huge structures, yeah. And of course, the British intelligence found pretty soon out what was going on, and they started bombing these construction places, yeah. pretty badly. They put a big effort in that. And as a matter of fact, these buildings were never finished. Mm-hmm. And I experienced such an air raid myself. I went with the chief communication officer in Dombecker staff. I went to France in May 1944. And we went to one of these construction places, and quite a sudden the sirens went on. Yeah, and it was in the afternoon at 3 o'clock or so, and the British came. Yeah, and we had a good bunker for air raid bunker, so we were not in danger. But I experienced such a bombing of such a construction site, and these things flew in the air. Yeah, all these wooden structures, yeah,
for scaffolding,
yeah, and anything. Yeah. Was terrible.
Very frightening.
Yeah, and so Dornberger was, from the very beginning, he had a better feeling for that. He was an artillery officer from the First World War. Yeah. He had a much better feeling of that and propagated this mobilized employment right away. And of course, after these things happened with these construction sites, and it was clear the answer is the mobile.
Only the mobile was going to work. Yeah. I guess for a while they were actually in parallel, right? They started working on road mobile in 1943 already,
yeah, well,
and building the bunkers at the same time.
Then they said, okay, we can finish these buildings, but we would pretend that we continue constructing them because we attract the British and American bomber force. Mm-hmm. Do these construction sites instead that they are going to Berlin and Hamburg and Köln and destroy our cities. Yeah, so it was a kind of camouflage, yeah, for a certain while to continue, but there was no the idea that it would be used for.
But is it true that earlier on, before this whole argument was finally settled, that in fact it was von Braun and other members of the team who really did think that you needed a bunker with a military version of a test stand to have to deal with such a complicated missile?
I don't think that was so much the idea, mm-hmm. Rather than to have a good protection, yeah, for the preparations, for the planning preparations. Yeah. What he, of course, did not know, what Dornberger knew from his war experience, that camouflage is a big factor, yeah, in your employment. And so we could do all these things which von Braun wanted to do in a bunker with our fleet of trucks. Yeah? And they could go in any place. Yeah? As a matter of fact, they usually would look for a small forest in smaller size, yeah, and go into, well, we couldn't call it a road, just a path rather than a road, yeah, go into there, and for camouflaging, they took the tree tops and bound them together, yeah, to camouflage the side from the top. Never anything happened. Not a single time.
It was just almost impossible for the Allied aircraft to find those batteries.
And since they were so flexible, yeah, in building up and packing in again, yeah, that could be done in such a short time that even if a resistance fighter would notice they are there, yeah, before the message was in London or what do I know, in the bomber command, and they disappeared in any direction, nobody could tell. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. And they made a point of moving fairly often in order to be hard to find them.
Sometimes even not that was necessary. And then these are things I don't understand. Of course, they had intelligence people all over the place. Yeah? And we had two groups. We had the southern employment group and the northern. And the Northern Employment Group went into Holland, and they fired from Den Haag.
From The Hague.
Yeah. And what they did, there was a hall from a Dutch movie company, and they cut a hole in the roof and fired from this hole. They never were molested.
It was just too...
Now, one explanation would be, of course, they must have found out that we were there, yeah? At least through the Dutch and the Dutch resistance and whatnot. But real to do enough damage to our firing units, they would have destroyed too much of the town and killed people and so forth.
Right.
That's the only thing we can
civilian casualties.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. No, that was certainly a consideration in bomber command targets that you don't bomb friendly civilians.
Yeah, yeah. But in the end, they got so mad. I read from British intelligence reports. They got so mad that they said, "Well, we don't care anymore. So we have to kill the Dutch people and just to get rid of these darn middles."
Right. It was frustrating for them. Okay, so we. I want to get. Obviously, we have to get into your discussion of your whole period with Dornberger staff.
Right.
From 1943 on. I had a question that about Dornberger that, though from an earlier period, that I didn't get to ask before, which sort of got lost. And then I want to move into this other. You used the phrase, Dornberger's phrase, alles unter einem Dach, that is everything under one roof, that bring all of the development laboratories and everything together into in Peenemünde. Which sort of implies, in effect, that the government-owned laboratory is much larger and stronger in comparison to the contracting industry companies. Do you know about when he said that phrase, Allison? When he came up with that, roughly, or do you have any recollection of the origin of that?
Well, I suppose... I didn't see any document on that, but I suppose it was a decision made at the time when they realized Kummelsdorf is much too small, insufficient facilities and so forth. At that time, they designed the plan for Peenemünde.
Right.
And the concept was everything under one roof.
Okay. A big development facility.
Right. You see, Dornberger, in a certain way, had experience with industry from his solid propellant rockets, the artillery rockets and so forth. Yeah? And he knew what he could expect from industry and what not. Yeah? And he knew that the industry, contrary to what they said afterwards, the industry was not at all interested in rocket development.
It didn't know anything about it.
Yeah, and they thought they couldn't make enough money with it. Much too costly for them.
So at that point, he didn't feel that there was much that could be done. Was there secrecy considerations, too?
That, too, of course.
In concentrating the rocket development in one place. So that concept seems to have involved then with the plan for Peenemünde, as far as you recall it. And as far, I mean, the interesting thing about that, and certainly, again, it sort of jumps out of chronological orders, is the way it compares to the American way of doing things, especially what became the Air Force and NASA way of doing things, is primarily you contract out. And the contractors build the equipment, they do a large, significant part of your development, you don't have a big in-house
capability. The real story is, when we came over to this country, we more or less continued Peenemünde.
Right.
The same concept. Yeah? One of the reasons, again, was that the industry didn't have any capability. Yeah? They had to learn from scratch on. Yeah? And the army didn't want to lose time. Yeah? They felt
the
already
US
what's going on with Russia and... Cold War and whatnot, yeah? And they said, well, we better go busy.
Right.
And so they supported our concept. Yeah? And I really have to admire these officers, you know, that they had enough understanding for that. You know? Particular Tuftoy and even Hamill, our commander, you know, mm-hmm. and so on.
Was that also due to the fact that in the U.S. Army there was an arsenal tradition, an arsenal system of U.S. Army-owned arsenal facilities? Do you think that had anything to do with it?
It might, yeah.
I mean, I think this needs to be explored by historians, but at least many historians now are suggesting that there is a real divergence between the Army and the Air Force way of doing things. When the U.S. Army Air Force split away, it always had a close relationship to aircraft contractors, right, whereas the Army had an old arsenal tradition.
Yeah. And they had a very strong ordnance corps,
right?
With the technically trained officers. They were pretty good, by the way.
So that you were fairly, although obviously the American rocket development was greatly behind where you were when you came, you were impressed with the U.S. Army ordnance people.
They at least were understanding. They didn't say we know everything better because they didn't know. Mm-hmm. And they were very willing to learn. Yeah? Mm-hmm. So, as a matter of fact, we had pretty good relations with the officers. Contrary to the NASA, it was not easy to deal with the NASA people.
The NASA management
outside of Marshall. They're so arrogant, yeah? And we know everything better, yeah? And you shut up. And of course, we were a team. We were strong enough, particularly with such a leader as von Braun, to say, well, let's prove who's right and who's wrong. Eh?
Right. Mm-hmm. I want to get, soon you want to come back to the American period, but as far as, I'm still interested in this comparison. In Germany you evolved what amounted to a strongly government-owned facility where you had very large development capability in-house and even a manufacturing capability on a small scale in-house. So do you think that was mainly because of the inadequacy of industry at that time, German industry to deal with this, or lack of interest?
All you see, there were two things. First of all, there was no capability for such a kind of a development in the industry. On the other hand, at the same time, we had to learn, and we could do it only the empirical way. Before we could tell the industry do it this way and that way, we had to find out ourselves. And so I think that was the most efficient way to do it.
It was far too slow to send out contracts.
Of course, it's
when the technology
contracts is something for manufacturing, but not for development.
Right. Okay. So it. Do you think that it started with the sense that the industrial corporations didn't have the capability, and over time you really sort of also became, this is seemingly what's been indicated in other sources, that you became convinced over time that it was also the most efficient way of doing things, that you liked working with strong development laboratories and even a production capability in the team, in the group. You concluded that was the most efficient way to
tackle
these.
Now, to give you an example. Particularly with control and guides. As I told you, there were Kreiselgeräte who did control systems for the Navy. There were Siemens who did control systems for the Air Force. So, of course, we said, well, let's use that capability. For instance, Siemens was pretty strong in manufacturing of gyros and of the servo motors for the rotor actuation, yeah? But they didn't have anything of control theory. It was absolutely lacking. Yeah? So we had to build it up ourselves. And we are fairly lucky that we had people like Stoiling and his co-workers, like Geisler. He was a very talented man, and Stoiling's team. Yeah? And Häusermann and Dr. Ludwig and
and so
the industry in those terms could not anything offer. I remember many discussions with Dr. Gievers of Kreiselgeräte. Yeah?
Right.
Of course, since I was on board measurements, I participated even then in control conferences and so forth. And Guy was pretty frequently in Peenemünde. He had a hard time to follow Steuding.
To you, Steuding was too advanced for him.
He was a nice fellow, and he was definitely a lot of experience from his navy projects. But as far as theory was concerned, he was couldn't measure up with Steuding and his team.
Steuding was in another category altogether in terms of his knowledge, and so that taking this example in regards to the development of in-house or government laboratory capability versus corporations, if you hadn't done it yourself, the control and guidance thing, you wouldn't have had it done at all properly.
Probably not.
Because it would have taken
too
long.
Very bad time delay. Yeah, that's an unbearable delay. And we carried over this concept, alles unter einem Dach, even into NASA when we were transferred to Marshall. Eh?
Right.
In spite of their objections. And I'm telling you, of course, we had a lot of discussions among ourselves here, yeah? The old team members, about the Challenger tragedy. Yeah?
Right.
And we said, now you see it. They threw our concept overboard and had this contracting thing, yeah? And they had to bear the consequences. Yeah?
Right.
I mean, it might sound arrogant, but it's not only my opinion, but the general opinion in our old team. If we had been in charge, Challenger would never have happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, this gets us a long ways from where we were, but I'm just curious. Would you even have gone with the solid rocket motors and so forth? No, that's what
from
I thought.
From round one, NASA headquarters, the very beginning of the shuttle program, stay away from solid boosters. As soon as human life is concerned, then we want to go safe, and the liquid propulsion is much safer than the solid
rocket boosters.
And you got the proof of it.
Yeah, and unfortunately now we're committed to using those things for a long time to come.
Yeah, because particularly since the industry lobby is so strong that it would take a very strong effort to go back to liquids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know there's this whole thing about the advanced solid rocket motor, and that was heavily criticized recently, and some people and said they should have developed a liquid booster instead.
I mean, why didn't we start in Germany with the V2 as a solid propellant rocket? There is two reasons, very important reasons. The first thing is the efficiency of powder per weight is about up to 30% less than the same weight of liquid propellants. So you punish yourself weight-wise. Eh? And the second thing is, for these huge sets of powder or solid propellant units, there were not any press. They are pressed in the container like these rings. Yeah?
That's because at that stage the only solid propellant you had was black powder, right?
No, we had other things too. But these machines, the machine tools, were not available to manufacture such large units of solid propulsion.
Okay, but wouldn't you agree that in the long run, I mean, for military missile capability, the United States has become almost totally solid rocket motors, because that's the thing that makes sense militarily. That is, in terms of firing it on a moment's notice and not worrying
about
fueling.
Response, yeah. But I think they have this distinguish between the tactical employment and the strategic employment. For the technical employment, quick response might be essential, not for strategy. I mean, if you fire a missile at London at 11 o'clock or 11:15 or 11:20, that doesn't make a bit of difference in strategic terms.
Yeah, but if you're in the current nuclear arms race where you have to worry about almost instantaneous launch, then there is a solid.
Yeah, well, I mean that's another story altogether
from what you were involved in.
In this deterrent thing, it's just simply foolish.
Yeah. Well, I guess that could get us a long way from where we were.
Sure.
We're talking about.
But of course, I mean, in the long run, we had to make such considerations. For instance, the difference between solids and liquids, and that bears on and on, even for the shuttle problem and follow-on projects.
Okay, now the tape is almost over, so let me stop here.